rescued me just in time from perhaps suffering a worse fate than just a few bruises. It was the magic pattern on steroids. But I didn't use that childish term anymore. I had graduated to faith in a personal, loving creator who was always with me. It seems silly to me now that all my life I had believed in something akin to a cosmic computer, which, keeping track of my smallest thoughts and circumstances, occasionally employed some supernatural algorithm to make things happen in my life as if by magic. Yet, oddly enough, it was easy to think of the devil as a virus that threatened our innermost processes and could crash our entire system unless we bought into some really solid protection. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, and at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when I had done everything I could to prep dinner and already set the table, I opened the door to the study and stepped inside. The space was still and silent. Maybe the books covering two walls from floor to ceiling helped insulate the room from sound, as did the dark wooden furniture, a desk and three tables of different sizes that all appeared to be antiques and extremely old ones. There was no computer, but traveling as much as he did, Matthew undoubtedly preferred laptops. A large Middle Eastern rug covered most of the floor, and the window blinds also appeared to be made of wood. They were all down and closed, so the space was shadowy and peaceful. My brief yet emotionally charged encounter with Matthew yesterday was making me curious about him and what he did for a living, where he traveled to, and why. I didn't feel like I was snooping, for the room mysteriously seemed to welcome my curiosity. It certainly heightened my imaginative powers. But of course, I wasn't about to rifle through any papers the desk might contain, like a detective searching for evidence of a crime. No, what I was searching for, I realized then, was evidence of the miraculous. I knew I wouldn't find it, but just the fact that I was searching for it was exciting. In the silence, Matthew's voice rang in my head and in my heart as I thought of Liba and her father and all the intolerant violence happening every second everywhere on Earth.
Have you lost your mind, man?
Without touching anything, I stepped out of the study and closed the door respectfully behind me. I wouldn't have known what to do next if it hadn't been for the book in my bedroom, which was always there waiting for me to open it. And I shouldn't have been surprised at how relevant today's reading of Matthew was for me. But don't be afraid of those who threaten you, for the time is coming when everything that is covered will be revealed and all that is secret will be made known to all. What I tell you now in the darkness, shout abroad when daybreak comes. What I whisper in your ear, shout from the housetops for all to hear.
Matthew 10:26-27.
I would have liked to take a shower before dressing for dinner, but that wasn't an option until Carol returned with a new shower curtain. What had happened yesterday wasn't the bathtub's fault. In fact, I felt we had gotten to know each other very well, and were now intimate friends. I had just opened my closet when my phone chimed that I had a message. I grabbed it eagerly, but immediately dropped it back on the bed when I saw an email from my mother. There had been some very nice things about not having a phone, such as knowing my parents were far, far away and couldn't reach out and supervise my every action like they could now. Oh well, I had nothing better to do. So I sat down and read these totally shocking sentences. Mary, dear, I had a lovely dream with you the other night. My parents were there, and they looked very happy as they watched us walk into a beautiful mansion together. That's all I remember. I've talked to your father, and he says it's a great idea to go spend the holidays with you in Egypt.
Mom remembered being in my dream with me?
I saw her face again then. That wistful expression, and how I had interpreted it.
Wow!
Then I read the last sentence again, and quickly decoded it. What it actually said was,
Dad is suspicious of the special someone you've met and doesn't trust you to be alone in Egypt anymore. During dinner, I announced, "My parents are coming to Cairo for Christmas." Carol gasped, "What?" Steve said,
"Great."
Simon kept chewing. He seemed to be avoiding my eyes. Was he that mad at me? Without taking his eyes off it, he complimented me on the food. By the time Steve and Carol were in the kitchen doing the dishes, I couldn't take it anymore, because now Simon was staring down at his phone. I said quietly, "Simon, are you mad at me? I'm sorry about what happened." He finally looked directly at me, and the surprise in his eyes was immediately replaced by another emotion that made me think of the statue of the noble man T in his serdab, whose eyes were made of shiny black stones. Simon's eyes resembled blue stones, which frightened me a little as I sensed it was anger polishing them to an almost blind sheen. He said,
"It's Hamoud I'd like to get my hands on. I can't believe."
He shook his head and stared fixedly down at his phone again. I smiled. Simon wasn't upset at me. He was upset for me. Abruptly slipping his phone back into his shirt pocket, he folded both hands on the table before him and, staring steadily into my eyes, stated,
"I can't pretend to approve of what you did."
What I did?
Mary, you evangelized to an underage Muslim, for Christ's sake.
Evangelized? It was Liba who came to me and asked me if I had dreamed of Jesus, too. It was Jesus who told her to read the Bible, not me.
But you're the one who gave it to her to read. But of course, it was Steve who gave it to you first. Why can't Christians just keep their Bibles to themselves?
But she wanted to read it. What did you expect me to do?
You might, he sighed, have refrained from getting involved in the personal lives of people you don't even really know. You might have shown more sense by putting reality before dreams. You must have known how dangerous it was for her to even flirt with the idea of Christianity. But instead,
he shook his head as if he could find no words for my stupidity, immaturity, foolishness, whatever. So you're blaming me for what happened? It's my fault? But wasn't it also Liba's decision whether she wanted to pay attention to her dreams or not and read the Bible? Or was I supposed to take the side of Islam and her father, even though I truly believe it's her right to be able to find out more about Christ if her soul so compels her? Because you see, I believe in dreams, and not just the ones we have when we're asleep at night, but the ones we dare to have when we're awake and want something more than what's been programmed for us. And I also believe in the power of dreams, because I've had some experiences since I came to Egypt that tell me not all dreams are confined to our brain.
Fortunately for you, because it means you still have a place to stay, Matthew is of the same opinion.
He looked past me toward the kitchen, almost as if he suspected his assistant of seducing his fiancée into falling in love with Jesus as they did the dishes.
Matthew says you acted according to your conscience, with generosity of spirit, and without letting fear dictate your actions.
He said all that about me? I hope he's not too upset about losing Hamoud and Ozzy. Carol said they'd been with him for a long time. Emerging from the kitchen and returning to his seat at the table, Steve asked Simon,
"What are you saying to my girlfriend?"
His tone was casual, but I was very glad the stern look in his eyes wasn't directed at me. I spoke quickly. "He was just telling me about his friend, Matthew, weren't you, Simon?" His phone vibrated.
"Excuse me,"
he muttered, and he had apparently received a very long email because he didn't look up again. It was Steve who told me, once we had moved over to the couch and seated the table to Carol and her fiancé, that Matthew wasn't actually a friend of Simon's. They had met at some embassy party, the sort of highbrow gathering to which Simon regularly got himself invited when he was soliciting funds for his Saqqara project. Most of his money had come, not surprisingly, from the wives of wealthy diplomats, more interested in possible erotic pleasures with the handsome Egyptologist than in ancient treasures. Matthew Waters had not given Simon any money, but had simply put his Garden City apartment at his disposal, along with the attached domestic staff. Steve concluded,
"I owe him big time, because that's why Carol ended up living here, in a place large and comfortable enough for her best friend to come and visit her for a month."
He kissed me. Resting contentedly against him, I asked, "Do you know what Matthew does for a living? He seems to do a lot of traveling. Carol mentioned he was away in Europe for a year. He must have a home there, too?"
"I don't know any more than you do, Mary."
"He seems like a good person."
"I agree. I'd never met him before yesterday, but his behavior, how he reacted to the situation, and how he's handling it, inspires me to trust and respect him."
"That's just how I feel about him," I confessed. "He seems to genuinely care about Hamoud and his family." "Steve, will Liba be all right? What do you think is going to happen to her? She can't go home. If Hamoud dared to hit me..."
"Don't worry about her, Mary. Matthew has known and employed the family for years, and he's on top of the situation. Right now, Liba is safe where she is, and you have your own life to think about, Mary. You did what you believed was right, and you don't have any power now to deal with the consequences. Matthew promised me he would keep me informed, so please relax. I sense you've already forgiven Hamoud, and that says a lot about you. But you're not to blame for what happened, and you definitely didn't deserve what he did to you. Never think that. Do you hear me?"
"Yes. I feel sorry for him. But I don't like him. I really don't like him anymore."
"No one's asking you to. Forgiving is not necessarily synonymous with liking."
Chapter 17. On the second morning after my confrontation with Hamoud, my magical dream vacation in Egypt metaphorically collapsed around me stone by stone. I felt myself demoted from a beautiful princess with everything at her fingertips to a humble beggar. After I woke up, I lay listlessly in bed for a long time, assessing my ruined circumstances. To begin with, I no longer had a way to get around as effortlessly as before. Hamoud's big blue Chevy was history. I would have to begin spending money on cabs, or figure out how the buses and trains worked. The latter struck me as more impossible than learning how to read hieroglyphs. Cairo was vast. I didn't speak or read Arabic, and the Egyptian currency was still a bit of a mystery, and I barely had any on me, which meant going to a bank or something. I couldn't keep relying on Simon or Steve to handle all these minor details for me. I was no longer an inexperienced little tourist flitting around like a butterfly from one scenic spot rich with ancient nectar to another. I was going native and had to learn to fend for myself. Steve technically owned a Jeep now, but it was still parked at Simon's place, and besides, I didn't know how to drive a stick shift. Maybe I could learn, but that was Steve's vehicle, not mine. I felt better when I remembered he was soon to be my boss, and for delightfully flighty moments, I envisioned us spending every day together. I returned to Earth, struck now by the fact that I had no idea what my new part-time job would involve. My mood was such, I concluded I would hardly see Steve at all, who would be back in Saqqara searching for more passages beneath the sands that might lead to Imhotep's actual tomb, while Simon and Carol finished photographing mastabas for his book before the baby was due. I, on the other hand, would be back in Cairo, answering phones and filing, and whatever archaeological admins did. I didn't even know yet where I'd be working, but I seriously doubted it would be at the infamous Department of Antiquities. I hoped not. Carol was still around, although not fully, and not for long. Her whole being was, quite understandably, preoccupied with everything she had to do in order to move out of here soon. And the very day the movers and all the assorted stores where she had purchased furnishings were scheduled to deliver everything to her new Mahdi high-rise, she and Simon would be elsewhere in the city getting married while their building's BOAB supervised the deliveries to their new home. But they would spend only one night there before catching a train to Alexandria, where they would remain for a week honeymooning in a luxury hotel on the white beaches of the Mediterranean. At the thought, my lethargic pulse fluttered with excitement for a moment because, while his boss was on vacation, Steve would be free to do as he pleased, which meant I wouldn't spend a moment alone. Then I went back to being depressed because, for all I knew, the opposite might be true, and Steve would be busier than ever handling all the Egyptologist's affairs while he was away. And then there was the looming pressure of my parents' upcoming visit. It had made me happy how eager Steve was to meet them, for this indicated he was serious about me, but I had never foreseen this parental invasion on my dream vacation, which thought brought me back to square one. I was no longer on vacation. My tourist visa wouldn't expire for a few days yet, but sightseeing all by myself wasn't much fun. When I finally got tired of feeling sorry for myself, I sat up in bed and glanced at the clock on the nightstand. It was blank. My senses then registered the unnatural silence in the apartment. Something very important was missing. The subliminal, soothing whisper of the central air conditioner that enabled me to feel like a human being with the luxury to be depressed instead of like a plucked, oversized turkey being roasted to death. The power was out, not just in my heart, but in the building, and probably all through Garden City and beyond. My spirits completely crushed, I fell back across the bed again. There was nothing to do now except go back to sleep, but even that was impossible, because simply knowing the air conditioner wasn't working made me feel hot. Thank God it was December, which meant Carol and I had a chance of surviving. But that didn't mean we'd be comfortable. I remembered then what Steve had said to me on that magical evening on the train returning us to Cairo from Luxor, that a comfortable life wasn't what he was after. Before my mood and thoughts could plummet even further, I forced myself out of bed and literally ran from myself into the bathroom. It was a true blessing we still had running water and could keep flushing the toilet. All those romantic historical novels usually fail to mention the chamber pot concealed beneath the bed where the heroine's bodice was being passionately ripped. Back in the guest room, I avoided looking over at the Bible as I got dressed. I didn't feel like I deserved to even go near it this morning. Carol was right. I was a spoiled brat. I had everything I needed, and even all I desired. And I was still feeling sorry for myself. I thought of Liba, sleeping in a strange place surrounded by strangers but afraid to go home. But of course, that didn't make me feel any better. Turning to face my Bible but still not approaching it, I said beneath my breath, "Forgive me. I just didn't feel up to opening the holy book this morning." I recognized how odd this was. Considering the power was out and I had nothing better to do, this seemed the ideal opportunity to spend some intimate time with Jesus, free of external distractions, right? Yet apparently I was distracted by the very lack of distractions. If I opened the Gospels now, I would almost be obliged to dive in deep and not come up for a distracting breath until I had done some serious exploring of my innermost depths with the mysterious light of God's Word. I wasn't ready for that. Was I? Until now, I had spent only minutes with the Bible every day, but they had been incredible, life-changing, energizing, inspiring, mind-blowing, reassuring, and wonderfully challenging minutes. My soul sipped the Gospels like my mouth did wine. Breaking the invisible force field my bad mood had raised around the table by the window, I went and stood over my Bible and caressed the sensual leather cover. I would not open it at random today, seeking comfort. I didn't need comforting, because there was nothing wrong with my life. On the contrary, I was blessed in so many ways, I honestly couldn't count them. I felt thoroughly ashamed of my lethargic ill humor and self-indulgence. I didn't have problems. I had new challenges and opportunities. I was already dressed to meet the first one, venturing out into downtown Cairo all on my own. It was time to begin learning how to get around in my new hometown without always having to depend on others to show me around. Carol wasn't up yet. No surprise there. So I left her a note under her teapot in the kitchen. Down in the lobby, I was fortunate enough to encounter the building's Boab, who appeared delighted when I inquired about the nearest bus stops and train stations. Disappearing for a moment into a small room off the lobby, he returned with at least half a dozen pamphlets. Gratefully slipping them into my purse, I extracted what I hoped was an appropriate tip and asked him to call me a cab. I had taken my first step toward mastering public transportation by gathering the necessary information, but today I would simply go exploring the easy way. I had not spent more than 10 minutes aimlessly wandering the traffic and pedestrian-congested streets of downtown Cairo when I began to comprehend how silly I had been that day in the Cairo Museum when I imagined Richard was having me followed. Those men had not been sent by Richard, who was keeping a protective eye on me, but by my own naively romantic imagination. The truth seemed to be that a young woman walking alone in Cairo with her head uncovered was fair game for men, young and old alike. On too many occasions, I found myself seeking refuge in shops. I had no other reason for entering except to escape the man or small gang of youths who had been following close behind me. Some of them were even bold enough to walk beside me and whisper things in my ear. I didn't need to understand Arabic to get the gist of what they were proposing. When I replied in English, "No thank you," or "Please stop following me," a handful did me the favor of continuing to compliment me in English. None of them seemed to realize or to care how seriously I felt they were violating my personal space. Jogging to get away from my latest pursuer, I strove to lose him in a crowd of people waiting to cross the street at a busy intersection. I wasn't even wearing anything provocative, just a short-sleeved violet shirt over a knee-length black skirt, comfortable black sandals, and no jewelry except my little gold Ankh earrings. Sooner than I would have liked, I had just decided it was time to catch a cab back to Garden City, when a young man grabbed hold of my left arm near the elbow, his fingers pressing into the green bruises left by my collision with the bathtub, so that I cried out from the sudden, unexpected pain. Yet instead of letting go of me, he squeezed my arm again, forcing me to wrench it away from him and suffer even more discomfort. There was a smoldering look in his eyes, which seemed to say he was turned on by my bruises and could guess how I had gotten them by being a bad, disobedient young woman. I ran away from him to the curb, where instead of the cab I had been searching for, a black limousine pulled up. Surprised, I watched curiously as one of the back doors opened and a tall man in a white dress shirt and black slacks stepped out. Extending a hand toward me, he said,
"Get in. It's much too hot out here. I'll take you anywhere you want to go."
Approaching him, I said firmly, "Home, to Garden City." Richard smiled.
"Of course."
I slipped inside. I didn't have the presence of mind to wonder how it was possible to suddenly find myself sitting in a limo across from Sir Richard Gerald Ashley and his talent location scout, Owen Kempter. All my senses were heightened to such a degree, thinking was not only impossible, it seemed completely unnecessary in the almost shockingly comfortable circumstances, lying in bed that morning, I had not even remotely imagined such a scenario, but here I was, living it. Owen was also looking extremely elegant, in a long-sleeved white shirt over what I could now discern were black slacks, fine enough to be made of silk, which wasn't very practical, but it certainly matched the full sleeves of the shirt, which were embroidered down the front and along the seamless cuffs, with some abstract design resembling twining vines, but which I couldn't quite make out in the soft light. The dreamily accommodating seats were a soft black leather, and the fixtures were all a shining stainless steel. The driver, who Richard had ordered by way of an intercom to drive to the address I had given him, was not visible. Our chauffeur might as well have been in another universe, through which we glided silently at a speed of light, mysteriously obeying Cairo's relative speed limits and planetary traffic lights. I knew the city was still out there, hot, bright, noisy, dirty, teeming with life, but I could see nothing of all its dangerous charms through the dark curtains drawn over the windows. I wondered how Richard had spotted me. He said,
"Mary,"
and simply sat smiling at me. Richard. I had forgotten how handsome he was. No, he looked even better now. His softly waving black hair was unbound and rested against his broad shoulders, and there was the shadow of a goatee framing his jaw that drew my eyes even more irresistibly to the crescent-shaped scar below his mouth. Then something strange happened. Out of the blue, I thought of my grandmother and heard her voice in my head as clearly as if she was sitting in the limo right beside me as she said derisively, "He's a handsome devil, isn't he?" I quickly looked over at Owen, who sat to Richard's right, directly across from me. In the atmospheric lighting, his hair shone more gold than red, and today it framed his face in supple wings that seemed to melt my brain. They looked so soft, a beautiful frame for the masterpiece of his face. He was younger than Richard, possessed of perfect classical features, and he might have been an ancient portrait bust come to life because his irises were such a light gray, his eye sockets almost looked empty, white voids in which floated the black holes of his pupils.
"Mary,"
Richard drew my attention back to him.
"Owen and I were celebrating a successful business venture with a bottle of champagne. The same vintage, it just so happens, as the bottle I sent you at the restaurant, but which you rejected. I hope today you will drink at least one glass."
Owen pressed a button, revealing a secret cabinet, out of which he slipped a champagne glass that caught the light as if made of crystal. Very slowly, he filled it with champagne from the bottle I had already seen resting in ice to his right. Because I could think of no reason not to, I accepted the glass from him and waited. Richard said,
"I've had my fill, but I'm sure Owen won't mind joining you."
The younger man's pleased smile was almost blinding in the shadows as it made him appear even more beautiful. No wonder Ellen, back on the ship, had been so infatuated with him. I had also been aware of how handsome he was, but he looked different now, almost angelic, and not at all threatening. Maybe because Steve wasn't around and I didn't have to worry about being caught staring at Owen. It wasn't as if I desired him or anything. He was just a physical masterpiece who merited at least a few moments of aesthetic appreciation. Gazing at him as he poured himself a glass of champagne, I simply could not believe in evolution. That skull, that tall, pale forehead, those high cheekbones had never, I knew in my bones, been an ugly ape. Leaning toward me, Owen chimed his glass against mine, and we both drank. I regretted now having sent the bottle back at the restaurant. The champagne was nothing short of divine, and I had built up quite a thirst walking around downtown Cairo, sometimes even running to get away from my admirers. It was impossible to take just one sip, or two, or three. Before I knew it, I had drained the glass, and I felt I was in heaven as Owen, also having polished off his own serving, poured us both some more while at the same time bestowing upon me the most enchanting of smiles. Had I really run away from him at the Temple of Horus? Why? I couldn't remember now. Because he knew what I had dreamed about? But why had I thought that frightening? After all, I had shared a dream with Steve, and even Mom remembered being in a dream with me the other night. So Owen was a lucid dreamer, too. That was reason to strike up a conversation with him, to talk with him to see if he knew things, could point out techniques I wasn't aware of, which could help me master my lucid dreaming abilities. It seemed a very strange waking dream now that Steve and I had left the ship before it even reached Luxor, because we had both been afraid of Owen. Simply because he had kissed me? At the moment, this struck me as much more flattering than frightening.
Steve, would you like more, Mary?
The tips of Owen's fingers brushed mine as he took my second empty glass from me. I met his eyes, which no longer looked empty. In fact, his pupils were large and deep in the silvery cloud of his shining irises.
No, thank you, I replied, and wondered why my voice sounded so distant, almost as if it didn't belong to my body or had become detached from it and was floating away, taking my ability to think clearly with it.
You've been drugged.
But that wasn't possible. Owen had drunk from the same bottle, and just as much as I had, and he looked fine. Or so I believed, until he suddenly fell to his knees right in front of me. He had disposed of our champagne glasses, and his hands were resting on my knees now, but he wasn't bracing himself on them. His long white fingers were raising my skirt, and then slipping deftly beneath it to caress the tops of my thighs as he slowly coaxed them apart. It was all happening in slow motion, and yet also more swiftly than I could think, too fast for me to react, as I became timelessly lost in the warm, exciting, and yet also soothing sensation of his palms caressing my skin, then of his thumbs lightly tracing the lace edges of my panties. I cried, "Stop!" It was Richard who said,
"Mary, just relax and enjoy yourself. I can see the bruises on your arm. You've been treated badly, roughly. You deserve to be handled gently. Owen will help you feel better, and it will be our secret, I promise."
"Stop!" I pleaded, attempting to grab Owen's hands through my skirt, but he slipped them out from beneath it of his own accord. Seating himself beside me now, he abruptly pulled me onto his lap so I was straddling him, smoothly yanked my shirt off over my head, unclasped my bra, which opened conveniently between my breasts, and threading his fingers between mine, he held forcibly onto my hands while sucking ardently on my right nipple. I gasped, then whimpered helplessly, because the pleasure was electric, shocking in its pure intensity. But it was wrong, and somehow almost hurt, because my nipple was hard as a spark plug, flowing with the current of my life. And Owen's wet tongue was making it feel too hot, too hard, was putting me in terrible danger. I knew it. But when he transferred his attention to my other nipple, all I did was moan. My body was betraying me, and I was letting it. I couldn't stop what was happening. I didn't want to. The hot, sensual joy flashed straight down from between my breasts into my sex like lightning. There was no fighting as it blinded me to everything except the desire for more and more of these incredibly delicious sensations, building up into an irresistible storm of longing. But I had to fight it. It was the drug heightening all the sensory receptors in my skin, relaxing my muscles, dissolving my tensions, loosening my resistance and seducing me into feeling only these glorious moments mattered and existed because nothing else could compare to this. When I realized they were closed, I opened my eyes, but it was like being underwater and caught in a riptide, pulling me deeper into my blood's seductive currents. Yet I could still see clearly enough that it wasn't Steve holding me in his arms, but a stranger. "Stop," I pleaded. "Let go of me, please."
"Don't be afraid," he whispered,
and relaxing his grip on my hands, let my fingers slip out from between his.
"Mary."
Richard spoke my name almost tenderly.
"I promise you'll still be a virgin when you leave here. Owen wouldn't dream of hurting you. He simply wants to give you some pleasure, which you deserve, especially after what you've been through. And we both know your boyfriend, exemplary young man that he is, won't give it to you. It pleases me greatly to watch you relaxing and enjoying yourself."
While he was speaking, and I was hypnotized by the warm, soothing, reassuringly reasonable current of his deep voice, Owen had gently lifted me off him and back onto the seat beside him, but in such a way that my skirt was now bunched up around my waist. It was easy for him to slip my panties over my thighs, down my calves, and off. Time remained distorted, slowing down when I was consumed by sensations, then returning to normal speed whenever I resisted. My perceptions, my coordination, my intentions were all mysteriously jumbled, so all I could do was feel. When Owen parted my thighs and buried his beautiful face between them, I wanted to die. But instead, as the hot tip of his tongue flicked swiftly and knowledgeably in just the right spot, I climaxed. After my shameful cries died away, Richard purred,
"That's a good girl. You'll feel better now. Trust me. Or maybe a bit of oral sex is permitted before marriage for Christians. Is it even mentioned in the Bible? You'll have to ask Steve. I'll admit, I sent Owen on that cruise to look after you, and to help you realize you have desires Steve can't fulfill. Admit it, to yourself at least."
I couldn't move. With my eyes closed, I felt like a beached body. Richard's voice washed over like a relentless, chilling tide. I felt dead inside, the throbbing echo of ecstasy between my thighs, a possibly fatal wound to the trust Steve had placed in me. The searing climax, combined with whatever had been mixed with the champagne, made me docile as a mannequin, while Owen efficiently slipped my panties back on and smoothed my skirt deftly down around my thighs again. I kept my eyes closed, afraid of the expression I would see on his devilishly angelic face as he whispered in my ear,
"We'll meet again."
Then I felt him resume his seat across from me, almost as if nothing had happened between us. I was still a virgin, and this drug would wear off, and some day I might be able to forgive myself for being so stupid, 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 stupid. Richard, I was 100% sure now, had drugged me after our wild horse ride to the pyramids. It hadn't even occurred to me that Owen would willingly drug himself.
"Do you think you can walk?"
Richard sounded amused.
"You're home."
I opened my eyes and through the open door saw, as if in a dream, the tall white apartment building I now lived in. Then I finally looked at Richard, who was smiling at me, but not kindly or triumphantly, which sobered me up somewhat. Abruptly, I suffered the impression this had been only a minor skirmish in a much bigger battle. He had won this match by way of all the ramifications it would have on me emotionally and mentally,
and how it would affect my relationship with Steve. It hit me then, with the mysteriously bracing force of a revelation, that Richard wasn't as interested in me as he was in Steve. I almost understood now their weird exchange by the Mena House pool, where Richard had said to Steve,
"So, young man, I suppose this means war."
Because of Steve, I had become a disciple of Christ, and my soul knew beyond a doubt, as I met Richard's eyes now, that the attention he paid me was about Steve, and the influence he could have on me and countless other people. Taking my purse with him, Owen slipped out of the limo, and I accepted the hand he offered me because I felt groggy and my legs were weak. I focused on my purse as he handed it back to me, and barely heard the hearse-like car drive off. Chapter 18. There was no way around it. I should never have gotten into that limo. There were many reasons, which I had to admit were weaknesses. I had done so, and I went over them all that afternoon as I shriveled up in the bathtub, vainly attempting to wash off the shame of Owen's touch and tongue. Carol had no idea what had happened to me, and I had hopes she wouldn't find out, because the building's BOAB had not been in the lobby when I got back, so chances were he hadn't seen me dropped off by a limo. The only souls I intended to share my terribly pleasurable experience with were Steve's and the priest's, because I would have to go to confession, of course. Confession was easier to say than reconciliation, but was harder to swallow, because it meant blatantly admitting I'd done something wrong and had to fess up if I wanted to reconcile myself with God. When I returned to my bedroom wrapped in a white towel, my fingertips and toes as wrinkled as a newborn's, I found a text from Steve waiting for me. He was coming over. Right now. Oh, Lord. The text was 12 minutes old, and depending on traffic and all sorts of other mysterious chirofactors, he'd be here soon. After a moment of panic, I was glad. Better to get it over with. Much better. No point in waiting. If he was going to dump me for being a stupid little slut, a few more minutes of basking in his love wasn't going to help me endure the lifelong, the eternal loss. I chose the most innocent garment I owned, a white sundress with a high neck that fell to just above my knees, and white sandals to go with it. My face squeaky clean of makeup, and my hair swept severely up and back in a ponytail. I looked as much like a penitent novice as possible. I remained in my room, perched on the edge of my bed, hands clenched in my lap. Even after I heard the sound of voices in the living room, Carol's and Steve's, I didn't move. I sat rigid as a statue until I heard a polite knock on my door. Then I leapt to my feet, ran to open it, and flinging my arms around Steve's neck, began crying. That hadn't been the plan, but there was no damming the flood now. Without a word, he lifted me up into his arms and carried me over to the bed, where he seated himself, cradling me in his lap like a big baby. Then, in a gentle but firm voice, with a distinct note of command in it which instantly sobered me, he said,
"Tell me what's wrong. What happened?"
Slipping off his lap, where I didn't feel I had the right to be, I resumed the position in which I had waited for him, hands clenched in my lap, head lowered. I took a breath to speak, but then couldn't, and in those moments he got up and closed the door before returning to my side. Then I took another breath and told him everything, not once looking up, much less into his eyes. I didn't leave anything out. I described the experience in as much detail as I did my dreams,
Only this was a waking nightmare. The moment I stopped speaking and began silently crying again, he said softly,
"I'm sorry, Mary."
He didn't touch me. Through the corner of my eye, I could see that he was sitting up straight, his hands gripping his knees so hard his knuckles were white as ivory in his lightly bronzed skin. It was all over. I knew it. He couldn't possibly forgive me for betraying his trust like that, and for being so stupid and weak. I had behaved like a 5-year-old, climbing innocently into a van with a stranger who offered her candy. The tension in his body was terrible. It made my soul feel like it was about to snap. I couldn't cry anymore because I couldn't breathe. I couldn't keep on living. I wanted to die right this minute. And I felt I actually might have if he hadn't suddenly laid one of his hands on my clenched fists. His touch helped me breathe again as I whispered desperately, "I'm sorry, Steve. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Can you possibly forgive me? I know I shouldn't have gotten into that limo, but I was tired of being harassed, and it seemed like the easiest way to get home. I was so stupid, so weak, so..."
"Young?"
I was surprised into finally meeting his eyes, which were full of intense emotions which made them even more beautiful. He looked away.
"Mary."
I waited miserably. He was going to tell me I was too young for him, too easily seduced, too immature, too...
"Mary, did I blame you for what happened with Hamoud?"
"No. Where was he going with this? Did I dare hope?" Too late. Hope had already sparked in my heart, and there was no blowing it out now. Only he could do that with whatever he said next.
"Then why?"
He met my eyes again.
"Are you afraid I'll blame you for what happened today? You're right. You shouldn't have gotten into that limo. It was a mistake. One I'm sure you've learned an important lesson from. That the best way isn't always easy and comfortable. But what happened to you after you got into that car was not your fault. You were drugged and taken advantage of. You're so young and so beautiful, Mary. So desirable and full of desire. Your body just couldn't resist such expert handling."
Oh my God, was I getting turned on? The way he had said expert handling was so sexy. I was crazy. That drug champagne was definitely still not out of my system. Unclenching my hands, I grabbed both of his.
"Mary, you're protected and you're loved. It will help you make better decisions in the future to always remember you are loved. A sex object is just that, an object to possess and use and even grow fond of, but eventually it begins getting old in every sense, and then, more often than not, is thrown out and replaced by a new one."
Then I clung to the warmth and understanding in his eyes for all I was worth. "Then it's not over between us?"
"It has only just begun between us."
His voice hardened slightly.
"Did you let him kiss you?"
"No, I didn't want to kiss him."
"Of course you didn't."
He kissed me. I could feel how angry he was in his kiss, but not with me, at least mostly not with me. The fact that he was kissing me at all was proof he had forgiven me. But there was a passionate possessiveness in this kiss that thrilled me and threatened to make me behave even more badly, because this time I was completely willing. But he pulled away and, letting go of me, stood up. I did the same, not wanting to be more than a few inches away from him because I couldn't quite believe we were still together. He announced,
"I brought us dinner. But before we eat, I want you to have this, Mary, and wear it openly. I bought it for you this morning. It wouldn't surprise me if I was picking it out for you while you were trapped in that limo."
Reaching into a front pocket of his jeans, he pulled out a small brown cloth pouch, from which he gently extracted a very fine silver chain. and I saw now that from it hung a sparkling little cross. A moment later, the cross was resting against my chest. As pressing his body against mine, he secured the clasp at the nape of my neck. Then taking a step back, he studied my face.
It's white gold. Do you like it?
No, Steve. Reaching up, I lightly gripped the cross between my thumb and forefinger. I love it. Carol joined Steve and I for the falafel sandwiches he'd bought us with their accompanying sauces. We enjoyed them with the Stella Egyptian beer he had also provided. Carol must have heard me begin crying the minute I saw Steve, and so could easily guess something heavy had gone down in my room after we closed the door for privacy. As we ate, mostly in silence, she glanced at my new cross a few times. Right after we finished eating, Steve left. On any other day, I would have been disappointed, even hurt, by his quick departure. But this was no ordinary evening, where all that mattered was we were still together. How awful that while he was buying me this beautiful white gold cross, I had been letting another man go down on me. But I didn't allow myself to dwell on it. Before he left, when I escorted him out onto the landing, he had practically commanded me not to begin worrying and feeling guilty, and I gladly obeyed him. As soon as I stepped back into the apartment, Carol asked, "Is everything okay between you? You hardly said a word to each other over dinner, and when you looked at each other, you didn't even smile. Are you maybe feeling a little pressured by that cross he gave you to wear?" "No." I was too worn out and too profoundly relieved to find the energy to speak calmly. It was much easier to let it all out. "I feel blessed by this cross, given to me as a gift by a person who is also a gift to me from God. I feel completely, totally blessed, more blessed than I deserve."
"What did you do, Mary? Tell me right now."
"Oh, no." I shook my head so hard, my ponytail whipped me in the face. "No way." She grabbed my arm. I cried out, "Oh, I'm sorry." She immediately let go of me. "I forgot." "It's okay." I knew she had intended to pull me over to the couch where we would sit while I told her everything. But I just couldn't go there right now. "I promise I'll tell you everything tomorrow, Carol, after I get back from church."
"But tomorrow isn't even Sunday."
"I'm going to confession." I sighed. "Again. But right now, I'm going to bed. Don't worry, I'll tell you everything, but you'll need to cover baby's ears while I do." I knew her interest would be even sharper now, but instead of insisting, she surprised me by hugging me, briefly and lightly, because she had never been one for displays of affection. "Okay. Good night. I love you." Resisting the urge to cling to her as I fought back tears, I said quietly, "I love you, too. We'll talk tomorrow."
"You can go ahead and brush your teeth first," she offered.
"Thanks," I said. And quickly doing so, I was soon alone again in the sanctuary of my bedroom. I didn't even think about it. I walked straight over to my Bible, and praying my hands would be guided to find the passage I most needed right now. I lifted the heavy book, opened it, and as I set it down again, my eyes fell on the beginning of John 8. Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning he was back again at the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. As he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. They put her in front of the crowd. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." Then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. When the accusers heard this,
They slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?"
"No, Lord," she said.
And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." Jesus spoke to the people once more and said, "I am the light of the world. If you follow me, you won't have to walk in darkness, because you will have the light that leads to life."
John 8:1-12. I whispered, "Thank you, Lord," and bending over, kissed the page. Then, reverently closing the book again, I went happily, peacefully to bed. At the very end of the night, lying awake, I suddenly find myself kneeling in church with no one between me and the central aisle. I realize Mass is just beginning when I turn my head and see the procession passing me on its way up to the altar. Then suddenly, the tall, slender young man carrying the cross turns purposefully into my pew and lowers it toward my face so I can kiss the dark and featureless wood. My hands remaining clasped on the pew in front of me, I gladly lean toward the cross and, closing my eyes, kiss its smooth surface. I feel a little self-conscious about the congregation observing my devotion, but it doesn't matter what anyone thinks, for with all my heart and soul, I desire to surrender to this intimate communion with Jesus as I rest my forehead against the cross, sinking into its darkness and Christ's presence within me and all around me. I would like to remain there as I am, but after a few moments, forcing myself to make the effort, I raise my head and wake up for the day. Chapter 19. Between the square columns of two high-rise apartment buildings in Mahdi, the sun was beginning to set across the Nile River. From where we sat on an upper balcony of another equally tall building, we had a perfect view of the corniche below, lined with trees and waterside restaurants, of the narrow island dividing the river, and the distant west bank bathed now in a luminous rosy light that matched the dress Carol was wearing. She had been married that afternoon, and now Simon, Steve, and I were celebrating with small glasses of aged port. The bride was abstaining. I had not been present at the civil ceremony. Almost at the last minute, Carol had decided it would be better if I helped supervise the delivery of all her new furnishings, because she didn't trust the building's Boab to put everything where it belonged. So, armed with the handwritten list of items and their proper destinations, which she had thrust into my hands, along with her new keys and cash for the cab, I spent most of the day just standing around her new apartment, checking items off the list, as the Boab pointedly ignored me. I suffered the impression Carol had insulted him by sending me to supervise him. I would have been bored out of my mind if Steve hadn't kept sending me funny text messages, which I read out on the balcony in between enjoying the view. He had, of course, been one of the two male witnesses at the ceremony, which was strictly business and, it being Egypt, was delayed for unknown reasons. I felt centuries rather than hours had passed by the time he texted me they were on their way. But now, at last, we were all together again and relaxing on the narrow balcony that obliged us to sit side by side. This had its advantages, for we could all enjoy the view, but Steve kept distracting me from it by the way he rested his free hand on one of my legs, just above the knee, and every now and then caressed me in a way that made it hard to concentrate on what we were all talking about. His touch was respectful, but how breathless it made me testified to the fact that it was also possessive. The blood rushing through my heart knew exactly what he was telling me. that I would be his and no other man would ever again caress my thigh like this, slowly, intimately, promisingly.
Simon said, "Shall we go? I'm starving. Come on, honey. You still have more than a week before you have to begin slaving in the kitchen for us."
Pulling Carol to her feet, he kissed her tenderly on the mouth before she could reply. It was a joke, of course. We all knew that unless he was happy with rice and steamed vegetables, he'd be bringing home takeout.